was in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I thought I saw you standing there. Snow falling all around you like a silent prayer.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. That's Jimmy LaFave, Texas songwriter by way of Oklahoma, who we lost this week. Dan, I got to make you a mixtape of his stuff. We're losing a lot of people, but I was playing his stuff all week, and it really cut to the core. We're going to have a little bit later, in a few minutes, Gretchen Peters, who covered that song. But just a great, great voice and a great, great guy and a great, great roadie. Love Route 66. You love Crazy Horse. From Nashville, on the line, we have Michael McCall, staff editor, writer, and curator at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum since 2006. Gretchen Peters on the phone. Gretchen, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Okay, do you know Michael from Nashville? Michael McCall from the Country Music Hall of Fame?
I do. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Gretchen, how are you? I will say, you know, Dave, you said that she covered
it. What an odd way to run into each other.
It's her song. I know. She wrote that song. It's a beautiful song. So, and Jimmy did a great version of it.
Yeah. Gretchen, you knew Jimmy LaFave for at least 20 years. Tell me how you first became acquainted with him.
Well, he recorded a couple of my songs.
Are you there? Maybe it's that storm in Nashville. Michael, are you there?
Yeah, there's a big storm here right now. Yeah,
there's a big storm. So we lost her. She'll come back.
She wrote that song. She's she's a great songwriter. And one of the great things about Jimmy LaFave is he wrote songs himself, but he was really great at covers. You know, and he could take other people's songs and bring out the emotion in them. Yeah, which is one of his great qualities.
He was a huge Dylan fan, and told me once how much he liked Van Morrison. You hear, kind of keeping the thread with regionalism, can you hear his Oklahoma roots and that East Texas thing? I mean, or am I over-romanticizing that?
Well, no, I don't think you are, because I think if you hear how he sings, he had this beautiful high voice, and he'd draw out these notes. And that to me sounds, like Oklahoma wind, or it sounds like East Texas and the way that area of the country is. And he would sing like he had that history of that place. And I think people from that area kind of sing that way. You think of, Leon Russell or J.J. Cale all had, who didn't necessarily sing like Jimmy, but had that sort of regional sound to it. And I think Jimmy was affected by where he grew up and where he lived. And you can't help but be, even if it's subconscious.
He told me once that his love of Bob Dylan is what got him backwards into Woody Guthrie. He really became aligned with the Guthrie family and all that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, because he had the Oklahoma roots, and because he had, right, he was one of the people of our era that had this sort of integrity about his music, which is, rare these days in some ways. And I think the Guthrie family picked up on that, and they heard some of what he had sang. And I think the Guthrie family is very smart about looking for people who can keep Woody's memory alive. And Jimmy was one of those guys, and he could do it beautifully, and he could do it in a way that touched people.
Michael, did you work with Bob Johnston at all? I know he's passed away, but did you know him at all? From Dylan and all that?
I didn't know him. We have a big exhibit up right now that he's central to, because it's on Dylan Cash and Nashville Cash. It's called the New Music City, which is really how Bob Johnston brought Bob Dylan to Nashville to record. And he used, and it's funny because he used often some of the same musicians who were at times in Springfield, Bob Moore and Grady Martin and some of these, Tommy Jackson, some of these great guys who played in Springfield, ended up playing on some of these rock records that came out of Nashville after Dylan recorded Blonde on Blonde and Nashville Skyline and, Leslie Harding and some of the stuff that he recorded there. So Bob Johnston was the guy who brought him there. And Bob was a songwriter out of Texas, and he came to Nashville, or he became a Columbia producer after you know, sort of in the '60s or so, after Don Hammond and stuff, he sort of got recruited to be the one of the Columbia producers. And he loved Nashville, and he loved the fact that, you know, he brought Charlie Daniels there, and he recorded Leonard Cohen there, and but he also would work with Earl Scruggs, you know, so he and Marty Robbins, so he sort of got into both.
Is Gretchen,
and it changed Nashville?
Is Gretchen back? Because I want her to hear this. Is Gretchen back?
Sure.
I'm back.
Okay, because
crazy weather here.
Yeah, I thought you all were getting excited about the predators down there. You know.
That's true.
Big thunderstorm.
Sorry, Chicago.
Are you guys still smashing that car in front of the arena? It's like, do they do that for all the Predator games where they take a hammer?
Oh,
to
no,
the...
we do. We smashed in St. Louis and I know Anaheim.
But Gretchen, I wanted to hear this, and I want to get to some remarks you made about Jimmy on April 26th. But that's why I brought up Bob Johnston. I did a piece on Jimmy in '95, and Johnston said of Lefebvre, he goes, "One day when your voice gets heard on the radio, nothing can stop you. You have one of those voices that just cuts through all the clutter, and no one is going to be able to resist it." Can you respond to that, Gretchen, as an artist?
I'm using the present tense because he still is
right.
One of the most remarkable voices I've ever heard. I said, you know, in a piece that I wrote a few weeks before Jimmy died, that, you know, his usually you can trace the DNA of somebody's vocal style. You know, you can kind of listen and go, okay, they were listening to, you know, so and so and so and so and so and so when it grew up. But Jimmy was just almost like, I felt like he was just dropped in from another planet. His phrasing was completely his own. And one of the things I loved about what he did with my songs was they just became Jimmy Lefebvre songs. He kind of blew them up from the inside out. And he had, and it was very instinctual with him. That's the other thing that was incredible about his singing. I mean, one of my favorite things in the world was singing with Jimmy, but you never knew where it was going to go. It was always different. He didn't even use a set list when he played. The band didn't even know what he was going to do. And I've very rarely come across such an instinctual. He really was a jazz musician in a kind of certain way, because he was always improvising, and that was one of the things about his vocal style that was just fascinating to me. I never ever got tired. And then, you know, the other thing about his singing was it was just so incredibly soulful. You know, some people just have that ache in their voice, and Jimmy always had that.
You wrote on April 26th, Jimmy just didn't open a door in terms of interpreting other people's material. He blew out the windows and shook the foundation. I mean, what did you learn from him? And also, that's one question. The other question: you were here at City Winery with him for certainly his last show in Chicago, right?
Yeah. We knew, you know, he was very sick, and he at that point didn't want fans to know. He kind of didn't want the general public to know. And I mean, that City Winery show in Chicago will be in my mind forever. He looked pretty rough when we all showed up for soundcheck, and I thought, you know, God, I hope he's up to it. And when he took the stage that night, it was like he was emanating pure light. It was amazing. And I kind of figured out what he was doing at that point. He really was determined that that's what he was going to do for absolutely as long as he could do it. And right up until last Thursday night in Austin, where he came out on stage and sang one last song, and he died 4 days later. I mean, it was a beautiful thing to witness.
So you knew at City Winery that how sick he was?
Yeah, I've known. I had known for about a year. We just didn't know. I mean, you don't know, you know, how fast it's going to go and how much time. We didn't know how much time he had. I knew I did a couple of gigs that weekend, that including one in Chicago. And, you know, he was getting pretty sick. He was, it wasn't too much. It was probably the next week he started having to use oxygen. And, he was not feeling well. But, you know, singing was his great joy, and he was just determined that was what he was going to do. I think it really was who he was. And he said, I just want to, you know, he told our booking agent who we shared. I don't know if you caught that part of my thing before my phone connection went out, but he told our booking agent, you know, I just want to be on the road with my band and my friends. Book me as many gigs as you can. I don't know how long I have, but this is what I want to do. And that's what he did.
I know he was talking about wanting to come up here for the Fitzgerald's Music Festival on the 4th of July. He said that was on his list.
Yeah. He still had gigs on his tour calendar when he died last week.
Tell the listeners what that last show, it was May 18th in Austin. I think his last song was Good Night, Irene, but take us there and what that was like. He curated that show, didn't he?
He curated it down to the flowers that were on the stage. I mean, the program, the slideshow, he had his hands all over it. He told each of us what he wanted us to sing. I told somebody that night, I said, it's like he basically directed his own wake.
It was a beautiful kind of night I
came home, I flew home afterwards, and I couldn't really talk about it because it was so much more than, oh, it was an amazing night of music. I mean, it was an amazing night of love. He got so much love from the audience at Paramount in Austin. There were probably 30 of us on stage singing to him. He was out in the audience. He came to the show in an ambulance. That's how ill he was.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And so we didn't even know if he was going to be able to make it to the show, but we were just like we said, you know, we're going to meet you wherever you are. And he got there, and none of us thought as sick as he was going to end up on stage. But at the very end, after we had all sung his songs to him for close to 4 hours, I think, somebody said, make way for Jimmy. He's coming on stage. And they wheeled him up in his wheelchair. And his voice was very weak to begin with, but he asked for a guitar. and somebody gave him a guitar, and he cracked a few jokes to the audience, just like, you know, the Jimmy of old. And he sang, I can hardly talk about it without tearing up, but he sang a verse of Goodnight, Irene, which is a song that we did with him on the Woody Guthrie shows, the Ribbon and Highway shows a lot. And as he sang, his voice got stronger, and everybody in the theater was openly weeping. Everybody on stage was openly weeping. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And at the end, he took, he took a very, very, very long moment and a bow and said thank you. And it was beautiful. And I think he, you know, as sad a situation as that was, boy, we should all be so lucky to Ruthie Foster said, let's give him his flowers while he's still here, and that's what we did.
Well, thanks for sharing that. We got to take a break, and we'll go back. I want to talk a little bit about his legacy after this on Nocturnal Journey. Here's your face, just like you want. She'll make love just like you want. You know she tastes like a woman. She breaks like a little girl. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. And on the phone, we have Michael McCall from the Country Music Hall of Fame and singer-songwriter Gretchen Peters, both from Nashville. There, that's what we're talking about. The way he attacked, Just Like a Woman by Bob Dylan, right, Gretchen?
Absolutely. I mean, I think he's the best interpreter of Dylan there is. I think there are a lot of people that share that opinion, but I think he had this way of getting inside of the song and kind of blowing it out from the inside out.
Sure, yeah.
And an absolute fearlessness as far as making it his, and like I said, it was so instinctual on his part.
You know, we're going to wrap this up at the top of the hour, but it kind of ties in with we're doing this little project on remote music in Springfield and the Ozarks. And for both you guys, you're way more in the business than I am. Gretchen, you've been out on the road, and Michael, you've covered this, and you work at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and Jamie's here in the studio. What is it like for the artists? I don't want to say on the. I mean, I was listening to Jimmy all week, and I go, this guy should be playing. The Aragon Ballroom, at least in Chicago, you know, I mean, what is it for the artists? I want to say on the fringe, but on the edge and stuff, who don't get quite discovered.
Well, I don't know. I think that there's a bit of a fallacy in that whole sort of.
That's so true.
You know, on off switch. Or you're either famous or you're not. I mean, I think that if you find a sweet spot. If you're an artist and you can find that sweet spot where you can have a life, make a life doing this, and find a certain size of an audience, whether it's 200 people, 2,000, or 20,000, where everybody wants to come together and share a moment in a darkened theater or wherever it might be, most of us that I know, that myself and my friends that are out there on the road, feel pretty great about that. And the size of the audience isn't really the point. The point is kind of finding them out there wherever they are, and meeting them there. And I think that's what Jimmy did. And I think people from the outside often tend to look in and think there's some kind of binary, you know, you either make it or you don't.
Yeah.
Mode.
Right.
You know, it's such a personal thing, though. I mean, Michael and we talk about the skeletons, and the Dell Lords talk about the skeletons.
Right.
I mean, you'd go. I'd drive down to Springfield, and I'd go see probably my favorite rock and roll band of all time, and there'd be like 30 people there, and I'd want to spread the word. I was behind them and stuff. It would always kind of like, wow, what's going on? You know, but
well, there's no question that it's pretty hard, brutal life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, I've had conversations with Joey Lee or John Prine, who at one point were frustrated about not being more famous, and then at some point realized that they had a certain freedom having the audience they have. And I think Gretchen's like that. You can be yourself. You know, you're not under a lot of pressure to pay a lot of people. But you have, you know, like you say, you from 500 to 3,000 people show up every night you play. And it gives you a freedom, and it gives you an artistic license.
That's exactly right. And I have to say also, for myself, I had the financial push at the very beginning of my recording career of a major label, and I was never more uncomfortable in my life. I mean, I pretty much knew, you know, off the bat, that was not for me. I didn't want that kind of white hot heat. And so I think it's different for every artist.
And to wrap it up with Jimmy, I mean, the way Jimmy went away, I mean, it's just he went out on his complete own terms. I mean, total independent, you know, just total independent guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And if we have time, I'd say that, you know, when you say Goodnight Irene, that goes back to regional music and Al Lomax and Lead Belly and Lomax going out in the country and finding all these singers who are great and Rudy Guthrie being one of them. You know, so that idea of this undercurrent of music that's not necessarily the top commercial stuff is so important to what America is.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, you guys. That was a great segment. I talked to Jesse Lefebvre today, and we're thinking about maybe doing something again in July around his birthday. So, Gretchen, would you guys want to come back and talk a little bit more?
Absolutely.
If you got time.
I'd love to.
I want to spread the word.
I'd love it.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us on a stormy night. And thank you, Gretchen Peters, Michael McCall, and go Predators, right?
Man. Yeah, exactly.
The town's pretty excited, huh?
Yeah, they are. And it's such an honor to be on here, Gretchen, I have to say. Yeah. She's one of my favorite songwriters, and it's so important to Nashville.
Okay. So. Thanks, you guys. Take care of yourself.
Take care. Thanks. Okay.